Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. This is our 9th episode, and today's guest is Ryan Broderick, the creator of Garbage Day, a beloved and Webby Award-winning newsletter about having fun online. Ryan's been running the newsletter for 5 years total, full-time for 4, and before that, he spent a decade writing about the internet for publications like The All, Vice, and for 8 years, BuzzFeed. As always, thank you for listening, and enjoy.
I've spent, like, you know, 5 to 7 hours listening to content you've put out, reading content you put out, etc., over the past few days, but I imagine anybody listening has not done that. So, who is Ryan Broderick, and what do you do?
My name is Ryan Broderick. I am a tech journalist. I write a newsletter called Garbage Day, which I have been doing as my full-time job since 2020. And my major focus is, I suppose, trends in culture, memes, how the internet kind of is changing the way we think, how we experience the world. And I try to make that as fun as I can, but that's not always possible. But I try.
Yeah, I think I read this. This was in like a different newsletter. I think the Embedded newsletter from like 2011. And you said that if like the intensity of everything on the internet can goes up to a 10, you try to keep it at like a 6.5 at all times.
Oh, I don't remember saying that, but that is a great quote. I'm going to use that again. That was
cool. You can steal that from yourself. Yeah,
thank you, Pastor Ryan. I think that particularly after the Trump era, there was this real burnout from treating the internet like this massive, horrifying thing happening all the time. And so I think finding the right balance for people is important because you need some sugar to make the serious stuff easier to digest. So that's what I try to do.
Yeah, I agree with you that like the Trump era seems to mark like a turning point. But on the other side, like was the like it's hard to remember now because it was like 10 years ago. But was the pre-Trump era like, do you think that was less worse? Just I'm curious.
For sure. I was writing for digital media outlets then, and I was doing the same kind of work, and it was very new. Like I remember like the first time I ever pitched something about 4chan to an editor, and there was just like a total lack of understanding of what it was, what was going on. I think it was like a fake Twitter trend called Cutting for Bieber, where like 4chan guys were like pretending to be Bieber fans, and they were like harming themselves because Justin Bieber had been photographed like smoking weed, and they were going to like cut themselves to make him stop or something. And it was something ridiculous. And I watched the switch happen around, you know, in between like Gamergate and the rise of Trump, where these bizarre, frankly, like shaggy dog stories, these sort of people on the internet doing this weird thing. It doesn't really matter, but it's kind of funny. It's kind of interesting. They started to change. And then all of a sudden, like CNN was talking about it, and it was like major news networks were covering this stuff. And a lot of the nuance, I think, got stripped out. So I've been trying to bring the nuance back just a little bit.
Yeah, the crud rose to the top rather than the cream and has kind of stayed there.
Yeah, I think American media has a tendency to turn the volume up to 11 on everything. And when you do that with the internet, you lose some really important details, particularly because like the internet is just people messing around. And I think when you forget that, you tend to overstate the importance sometimes.
Yeah, no, I like that. So for years, you built your career as a journalist, and now I would definitely term you a creator. That word creator, though, I think is slippery, and I've got my own definition. Maybe you've read it in the newsletter. I'd love to hear how you define the word creator.
A gig worker for content. I don't know. An Uber driver for posts. I feel like
that.
the creator economy, yeah. The creator economy has gotten a lot better over the years. It's become a lot more manageable. Even 5 years ago, this writer I really like, a friend of mine, Brian Feldman, sort of wrote this piece about how there was no middle class on the internet and how the chips were stacked against anyone trying to build that. And I think it's gotten slightly better. Right now, I think a creator is someone who is making stuff online in formats that do not fit or are not appreciated by larger media corporations. But now many creators are beginning to pivot into proper media corporations. So I think we are at a turning point with a lot of this stuff. So I think for right now, it's just, it's people making internet content as the main thing. It's not like they're making something online to be read elsewhere or to be seen elsewhere. It's like they are operating online fully, and the rest of the world is beginning to catch up. So if you're not a creator yet, chances are you might be by the time you hear this episode. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay, a few things are there. One, the Uber driver thing. There was another, digging into the Ryan archives. This was on the Follow Friday podcast. This was like in 2022, I think. You said something, and you might have been quoting a friend of yours, but you said something about like how you don't want to be the Uber. You don't want to work for the Uber of your industry, which that resonated with something I thought of first, which you just said too. But when I was talking to Casey Lewis, like a couple months ago for this podcast, we were talking about Substack and like how Substack, you know, takes the fees and such, and we don't need to get into a conversation about Substack yet. But that was the first time I thought about it, where it's like a creator is, yeah, the gig worker of the creator economy, whether it's like on TikTok, you're just creating for TikTok rather, and the people. But anyways, I think that Uber for content thing is like very darkly true.
I think it's true. Although I will say, like, the more that I've become my own media operation, the more I realize that like you're always somebody's Uber driver. Like there's just no way to get around it. But I think the reason why I get kind of nervous about stuff like that, and why I think a lot of other creators get nervous about it, is because you want to sort of maintain a sense of agency about how you're making stuff. And most large platforms at a certain point in their life cycle will start to make your content have to fit a certain shape to be promoted or to be prioritized by their algorithms or their recommendation network or whatever it is. And when that switch flips, it never flips back, and it's never ever going to fit whatever your platonic ideal of your content was. That was always sort of a major thing for me with Garbage Day, which was that like I wanted it to take a shape that I cared about and like fit what I wanted to do. And I didn't want to go tap dance for likes and subs mm-hmm. on YouTube and let YouTube decide who I was and how I spoke and how I reported and how I thought. And I think the average person is much more familiar with this phenomenon than they used to be because of TikTok, where, you know, you have people opening up the app. They watch it for a while. They realize like what they have to do to get people to see their content, and they do more of that. And if you take that all the way, you know, 6 months down the road, a year down the road, you don't really recognize what you're doing anymore. You're doing something else, and I think that can be very sad, and very alienating. And so, that's really what I'm kind of focusing on when I compare myself to an Uber driver, who I think are lovely, by the way. I don't want to say that like those people do a lot of very important work. And I wish that like they weren't so gamified by the corporation that is sending them around.
Well, which, I mean, that's what it's shorthand for, though, is that like you become just so,
I want to be clear,
just subject to the gamification. No, it's about being subject to like a tech corporation's gamification.
Yeah, it's taking the last bit of agency you have away from you. And in exchange, you might get money, you might get attention, you might get notoriety, but it can be extremely alienating. And I think it results in worse content over time.
Yeah, no, I agree. So there's this definition of a creator that I came up with, and I think now I agree with what you said. It's basically just you're creating content that's meant to be distributed online, and like there's no need to really overcomplicate it much. But I am interested in like the relationship between being a creator and being a journalist, as somebody who was a journalist has been a journalist purely for most of your career and then became more of a creator. But so my definition was that like, number one, the highest priority is that you're creating content to be distributed online. Number two is that you're doing so with no middlemen besides platforms. But like a journalist where you have an editor and an organization that you're accountable to, then you're not a creator, which gets into this agency thing you're talking about, where it's like you don't necessarily have the agency to make all these decisions. And then I put a qualifier about like platforms on there because I think that's just something you can't avoid. And then my third qualifier was that they're like monetizing it somehow, whether that's direct platform payouts or subscriptions or even like a much longer tail, like using what you're doing as a creator as like a business card, like a proof of concept. But so my question is like, what's the difference between a journalist and a creator, given that middleman idea?
I think there's very little. I've even seen like creator run newsletters that have editors. Like it is happening. It's really just about resource allocation and where you want to put that. But I do think like the major shift has been that in the 90s and the 2000s, people liked brands. They liked magazines, Rolling Stone, MTV. They gravitated towards institutions. And in the 2010s, the assumption was that if the institutions got on the internet fast enough, that could just continue. And I often kind of look at like the digital media boom of the 2010s as this weird side quest that kind of fizzled. But there was this real kind of skepticism around people who were not going to digital media outlets and who were trying to do it on their own, and they won. Like that's that, like even digital media outlets now are trying to find, you know, personalities that people can gravitate towards. That was actually part of the whole blow up around the Bon Appetit stuff, which I won't mention too hard on this podcast because we might go down next. It's a cursed story to touch. But I think it's a good example here where digital media was a lot of legacy brands getting online or venture capitalists creating the legacy brands of the future. And almost none of those brands exist anymore. I mean, Vice is gone now. That was like my first job out of college. And so the shift has really been around the consumer and the audience who want to know where their content is coming from. You can say all you want about Joe Rogan, but like Joe Rogan's fans like know it's coming from Joe Rogan. And that is a very different relationship than the New York Times readers who know it's coming from this amorphous New York Times editorial board. And as we've seen since October 7th with Israel and Gaza, like that can become very politicized very fast because I think there is a very kind of deep shift in how the audiences treat institutions. And now they treat them with a lot of distrust. And and whether it's right or wrong, and I think actually more often it's wrong to assume that the individual is more trustworthy, that is happening. And once again, I think that is probably part of what the platforms want. You know, it is not super conspiratorial to think that, you know, a site like Facebook or TikTok or whatever, YouTube, would rather destroy old institutions and replace them with new ones that they control. I think that was definitely part of it. But it has spread to everything. And even the most successful new digital media companies right now are based around personalities. My favorite example being Dropout, the unscripted comedy network launched by former College Humor people. It just sold out Madison Square Garden, I think, or it's about to sell out Madison Square Garden for their live show. And like the major funnel for that company is monetizing parasocial relationships with their hosts and their actors. And I think that is the future. I mean, even A24 does it. Like everyone has kind of figured this out. So in a sense, like everyone is kind of some version of a creator now.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, before there was celebrity marketing and then it became influencer marketing and now it's just all the same and it's back to just being celebrity marketing again. One thing though, you were saying about how like people trust institutions less, and I agree how it's like maybe there used to be this, you know, understanding that an organization like the New York Times has some sort of like journalistic objectivity, or like, you know, you extrapolate it to like, not that we need to get into this, but like the Supreme Court. And now there's all the people are more like understanding like things are politicized here. I've been wondering if like people are starting to like distrust institutions more, but do you think they carry that distrust to the individual at all? Like, is it a distrust of institutions and like a trust of individuals, or more of like a heightened media literacy and understanding that like no one person is objective, or is it just, no, I just trust that individual?
That's a great question. Actually, one I hadn't really considered. It's possible. I do wonder. We haven't seen like, okay, so the best example I could think of is like during the blog era, there were all these bloggers that blew up similar to our creators now. And then in the early 2010s, they started to aggregate together into digital media companies, Gawker being a great example here, but there was a bunch. And like these big bloggers would go and start things like Vox, you know. And that happened. That has not happened again. And the question I think a lot of people are wondering is, could it happen again? And it would really come down to like money. Is like, are the people with the money going to spend it to make that happen again? If it does, we might get an answer there, which is like, do you lose your street cred if you join an institution? But we haven't seen it, because the new model seems to be like the Marcus Brown Lee or the Mr. Beast sort of becoming the defector, sort of becoming people becoming their own media companies, and then creating a new set of values and incentives and audience relationships through those media companies. So so far we have seen the distrust of the institution and the trust of the individual extend over. So like, if you are a really trusted writer who's been independent forever and you start your own media company, the audiences do seem to follow you and seem to trust you and seem to think that that's that you're good. And this is good and bad because it also applies to like Barstool Sports. Like, you know, it goes both ways. But I do wonder if that would change if all of a sudden like a bunch of big YouTubers got hired by Disney or something. I don't know.
Yeah, or if Mr. Beast started a show with Amazon or whatever.
That'll be the real test here is like, which brand wins, the Amazon brand or the Mr. Beast brand?
I think it's the Mr. Beast brand. But so moving on, one more thing about journalism in this way, like I think this is on Ben Dietz's podcast. I listened to that episode last night that you were on. You said that you remembered as a young person being told that things were trends and it's less harder to tell now what's a trend because there's less media written by professionals, which I think goes into this thing that we're saying of like institutions aren't as trusted. And like, it made me think of, you know, that term, like we're losing the recipes and like very few creators like purport to put out hard news, right? Like, I don't know. I guess I worry that there's this loss of like journalistic standards, media standards. Like, do you think we're losing the recipes of journalistic standards as it goes to more of this individual model?
Well, okay. So I'll go a little deep here because this is something I think about a lot. I think the first thing to think about is that due to the First Amendment, every American is a journalist if they want to be. I once looked up like the first, I wanted to figure out like who was the first journalist in America. And I'm going to butcher this story and any historian listening can email me and correct me. But the broad strokes was it was a guy who got kicked out of Europe for committing libel. Essentially, like he had like a gossip newsletter about like European royals. So he left. He went to Boston. Woo. And he just proceeded to commit more libel and like keep writing his gossip newsletter. And so when I think about like the great historic importance of journalism in America, I just think of that guy who was like such an irrepressible asshole that he like couldn't stop writing gossip about rich people in Europe. And I think that like that's actually more inspiring to me. So the first answer to your question is like anyone in America can be a journalist if they want to. I mean, we've had cell phone footage win Pulitzer Prizes. Like we're safely on the other side of that now. The other thing is that journalism standards are always eroding. There's this great anecdote in the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary, which is a great 13 hours if anyone wants to spend it watching that, where they talked to a New York Times reporter who was embedded with the U.S. troops. And he was talking about how coming out of World War II, the assumption was that you would never report negatively on your own side. And there was this huge, huge controversy about whether or not he could report on what we now know were war crimes, right? Mm-hmm. Being committed by the U.S., these atrocities. And so even then, they were like, oh no, like we're losing the standards of journalism in America to these young people. And this has happened over and over. New journalism in the 70s where, you know, Hunter S. Thompson would take like a crap load of drugs and go to Las Vegas. Or like, it's always happening. So I think that's safe. I think what you might lose if this trend continues, and this does worry me, is the ability to throw real resources at something. Mm-hmm. The stories that matter are expensive and they're complicated. And, you know, I am not like totally anti-editor. I like having editors. I like working with editors, good ones. I like that. I compare it to like a producer for like a singer songwriter. Like you want like a, maybe not Jack Antonoff, but you want like a Jack Antonoff figure. Right. And I think that that is still true. And I do worry that losing that, at least in the short term, will make American journalism less impactful. And then the last piece, the most dangerous piece is that when news is delivered the way it's currently delivered in these little fragments and these little pieces that you see all over the internet, you never really get the full story. And it creates this vacuum for bad actors to just spew crap at you. And I think the average person is beginning to feel that now. And they're really struggling to understand what's going on because the voices have just quadrupled and it's just really hard to follow things. And I put the blame not on the creators in that situation. I put the blame on the institutions who are still struggling to figure out how to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, and it's also as it is with so many things, as people have to say, it's the phones, right? Like I think you said this on Ben's podcast as well, where you were like, And I agree with this, like anything that you're putting out is the same, like you're the same as a journalistic institution because it's all just stuff you look at on your phone. And I first learned that a couple years ago, you know, working in marketing at a B2B SaaS company where it's like, we're not competing with this other company. We're competing with, you know, everything else on your phone. It's, so that's the thing. It's like, and I think that's actually why people, especially like journalists often will bristle at the term content or creator, because it's like, it's just a flattening. It's like one of those hydraulic presses on TikTok where everything just, you know, shoots out of the holes at the end. Like, I don't know. So I think that's really, that's the problem, right? Like, it's not just the institute. Like, how does the institution fight that, the sameness of the phone?
Okay, so there, if someone listening to this or reading this can find this piece for me, I've been searching for this piece that I read like 10 years ago for ever since. And I've asked other people and they can't find it. And I know I didn't hallucinate this. But I think it was someone like John Herman at New York Mag or Max Reed at Reed Max Reed, back when they were writing somewhere else, wrote about this thing where in the 90s, you would go to the supermarket and all the tabloids would be next to the real newspapers. And the tabloids looked like garbage. So you knew that the National Enquirer wasn't good because like it looked awful. Like the production value was bad. It was cheap. And you kind of understood that like to be successful, it had to look good. When all of news started to be filtered through Facebook and instant articles back in the 2010s, that flattening, I think, was very, very detrimental because all of a sudden, all news looked the same. Online, there was no way to differentiate between, you know, uspatriot.eagle and NBC News. And that has only continued because now, actually, I think it's almost gotten worse because a lot of creators have gotten a lot better at making really slick content. And so it is really hard to tell. In fact, the only bright spot here is that the New York Times has invested so much money in their news site that like it does feel like a platform of its own. And it starts to feel like really legit compared to, you know, Garbage Day. But for a while, it was really hard to tell, you know, who had real resources and who didn't. And that is a platform thing. They absolutely flatten that.
And that they have their own app. And it's, I mean, you can just see it on Twitter or you can like go to their own app and it feels like this special polished experience.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I want to move to Garbage Day for a bit and then we'll get back into the mires of what is a creator and all that. okay. So the business of Garbage Day. Any stats you're comfortable to share? Subscribers, open rate, click rate, and if there's a single metric that you really prioritize above all else.
Sure. So right now, my subscribers, my total subscribers is just over 68,000. My click rate is 21%. And my open rate took a real hit after smart warming was finished. It has now begun to climb back up. It is usually in the mid 40s. I started to freak out a little bit after the beehive migration, but things have started to calm down and it's more stable than it was. And in terms of the business side, I can say that I have just under 3,000 paying subscribers, and I run an ad usually in every issue, give or take, which right now are just a couple $100, but that rate is going up if anyone wants to advertise in Garbage Day before it does. And it's enough where I can pay my bills, I can eat food, I can buy clothes, I can live a normal life. And I recently brought on a researcher, Adam, who is fantastic. Nice. So it's become its own little operation, and yeah, it's stable, which is it actually freaking me out a little bit because the media is never stable. But
yeah, no. So I mean, the click rate, especially there, is insane. You said 21%,
21.2%. Yeah,
wow. Because I think when I talked to Casey too, because industry average is like 2 to 3% or something. I talked to Casey and hers was at like 10%, and I thought that was wild. So 20% is crazy, which like I counted, and in a recent issue where you got, it's each of your issues is right under like 2,000 words, you had 34 links that were not counting like embedded TikToks and tweets and stuff and like your like usual like, you know, infrastructural links. We had 34 links. So it's like people come here to like find other content to look at in other tabs.
Yeah, I did not know the industry standard for click rate because back in my old hosting Substack, the click rate was like never very prominent, so I never really thought about it. In terms of like the reader behavior for Garbage Day, like I do think that the point with Garbage Day is to find cool stuff. I mean, the initial reason the newsletter was created was to create a place to organize stuff on the internet that didn't make me miserable.
I think first post you say there's going to be no news, I promise, and that's changed a little bit. But
I had to put that because I wanted it to be fun, and I was also like working other jobs, and I didn't want to sort of mix all those streams together. Now it's the main destination for everything I do, so yeah, it all goes in there. But from the very first issue, like I wanted people to have that experience of like clicking on a link and discovering something cool. So that is continued. That's great to me. And that's even why the little the tagline for every issue is like read to the end for, and that's like my little Simpsons couch gag. But it was also like initially a hack to see how many people got to the bottom of the newsletter, because I could look at the click through there and be like, okay, so this many people made it to the bottom.
I love the idea of a Simpsons couch gag for your newsletter, by the way. That's a great way to put it.
I think everything needs to have something like that. So yeah, people click and they click so much that actually the paid version of the newsletter is just more stuff to click on, because people want that. And I think that's cool. I think link aggregation as a concept went really out of fashion really hard during the 2010s. And I think the internet got worse because of it. So it's nice to kind of keep that going.
Yeah. I want to get back to that in a second, but I do want to talk about, your premium offering. So as far as I know, there's like, so you send three newsletters a week, like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I think it's premium on Friday and it's a bit shorter and it's more focused on link aggregation. And then you have the Discord, and then you also have Garbage Intelligence, which might be another tier. But yeah, so tell me, what is your premium offering? And then how long has it taken to get it to, you've been doing this for 5 years. How long has it taken to get 3,000 premium subs?
So the way it's set up was at first I wanted to keep as much of it as free as possible, but like I need to eat. So I started with just like interviews. I would just like paywall written interviews. And it was like an offering that people would pay for, but it wasn't like anything that people, you know, were really excited about. Yeah. And also I wasn't excited about it either. So I did the interviews, then I launched the Discord, and I was like, okay, well, the Discord takes time to kind of monitor, so I'll throw that in and only make, and I didn't want like thousands of people in there, because that's when communities start to suck.
You started your career as a community moderator, right?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have a bit of experience kind of like managing that. So I put those together, people were kind of into it. Then I was like getting bored of the interviews, and I was like, okay, I'll do a Saturday issue and I'll make that premium. And I did that for probably about a year. And I was like, I hate working Saturdays. This is killing me. And so last summer, I went on essentially like summer hours where I would just do a free issue and a paid issue on Fridays. And when I came back from the summer, I had sort of rejiggered all of my business stuff and realized like, oh, I can just do two free issues a week, Monday, Wednesday, and then do the Friday issue for the weekend. Fridays are the weekend. Like, that works. And I've been doing that for a while now. And I constantly want to change things up. Like, I have like such a bad kind of urge to pick that scab, but I also kind of tell myself that I have to move in 6 month increments to make sure things don't get wacky. So I'm currently thinking about how to change things. Also coming even down to like subscriber cost, like trying to figure out like the right balance, because I haven't changed my prices pretty much since the very beginning, like 2020. So things, because I didn't want to be an expensive newsletter, because I get messages from college kids who are now studying memes and digital culture, which is insane to me. I mean, Godspeed.
You're on the syllabus.
Yeah, I have been told that Garbage Day is assigned. And I have seen universities buy subscriptions and stuff. So I try to keep that in mind. But for right now, they're stable. And I want Garbage Day to be as accessible as possible, because I think the service of like sending traffic to other places is really important. I think of myself a bit like a DJ. You know, it's like you curation is a thing that matters. So I try to think about that, but I am getting itchy again to change things up, but I haven't decided in what direction yet.
Yeah. Okay, there's like a million things I want to talk about there. One, though, you just talked about curation, so let's talk about that. I think with Casey Lewis too, like she does a similar thing to you, and I described what she does with her premium offering, which is kind of what you do too. I mean, with Garbage Intelligence, it's exactly what you do, is this one-to-many consultancy, like a consultancy you can subscribe to, consulting as a service, call it, I don't know. Anyways, but that curation thing, I think this is just because I've been like obsessing over creators and different ways of being a creator recently, but I feel like curation is like having a moment, coming back, becoming more important, you know, the age of AI and algorithms, et cetera. Am I just like seeing a trend because I'm just looking at a thing myself? Or do you think like curation is becoming more valued and more important to consumers?
I hope it's becoming more important. My suspicion is that it's becoming more noticeable because people are getting more burned out. Mm-hmm. I also think that this might be kind of like a millennial aging into adulthood thing, where there is like this first online generation that is extremely burned out by algorithms, and they still want to use the internet, but they don't want to use the internet the way they've been using it. So I do think that's happening. I don't know if younger people are like, I have like a rough idea of the average age of the Garbage Day reader because I meet them. And yeah. So like I have this, I think I know what the average age is, but I don't know. I truly don't know if like curation will ever become mainstream again. But right now, I do think it, at least for me, it's been a good business proposition, which is that it's something that like major platforms aren't doing well for a certain kind of person, and that person is willing to pay some money for it. So I think it works. I don't know. I like it.
Well, it's that people will pay for taste, right? And that's what it is.
I think that's true. I also think that there are people who want to spend their time online better, mm-hmm. and not in a productivity sense, actually in the quite opposite sense. They want to have fun in a way that doesn't feel like they're wasting their time, but mm-hmm. they still want to have fun. And I think that is very powerful.
Yeah. Anyways, so you're hovering around 70,000 right now. Is there like when growing from zero to now, was there any like inflection points or like things that you did? Like, how did you get, was it like Substacks, you know, algorithmic recommendation stuff that got you here? How did you get here?
So when I was doing this, like on my lunch breaks, in 2019, once a week, it was like hovering around like 2,000 subscribers total, just free,
like, and New York just, media friends, yeah, and connections.
I think it was just something Twitter. That was like being dropped in Slack rooms and stuff. Then when I went full-time in August, it doubled to 6. That was probably like the biggest like single day, single weekend growth, which was great. And then it just started to like climb very consistently. The next big bump was when I did this experiment with Casey Newton and a couple other writers called Side Channel, where we created like a group Discord, which was really fun. We got Mark Zuckerberg to come on, and then like my readers bullied him for a while, and apparently it was like a big problem. But hey, I was like, hey guys, I gave you a shot to ask Mark Zuckerberg questions at a Discord. I feel like that's a pretty good, you know,
people pay for that.
And then the other big increase was April 2023. No idea what caused that. At least I may have at the time. But mm-hmm. 2022 to 2023 was like a huge growth year for me. And I think a lot of it was because I had kind of gotten into a rhythm with what Garbage Day was and its point of view. And I was like, I had really figured it out. Mm-hmm. And then things just kind of like steadily increased for a while. There was another jump up in 2023, this last summer, which is interesting because I was publishing very little, which is kind of weird and curious. And then and then there was a huge amount of activity when I announced I was leaving Substack, but that activity was largely from people's paid signups, because a lot of people had told me for a while that they didn't want to pay Substack. So giving them the opportunity not to was pretty big. And then with Beehive, the growth has been flat, give or take like 1,000, but I'm still getting signups from Substack, which come over. And so the new sort of project for this year is figuring out like what growth looks like on Beehive, which feels very like leaving Substack for Beehive feels very much like big fish in small pond to swimming in the deep blue sea of the internet. Yeah. And so trying to navigate that as my next project, but I have yet to figure out exactly how to do that. And it's also possible that like the newsletter boom time has just changed a bit. So I have to figure it out, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to, that's kind of my whole thing. I'm trying to figure that out too, which I think it is. I mean, like you say, it is the big deep blue sea of the internet. And that's kind of what I was talking about too, with like the more the marketing focused meta is you have to like figure out how to distribute content online. And then I think this is too, where like all creators either just stop or they just keep doing it as a passion project, or they become basically a media founder, right? Like,
right.
And that's what you are.
Yeah, it's wild to think about. I try not to, but yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I will say I've never advertised Garbage Day. I've never paid for ads anywhere. It's all been organic, and I do think, okay, so this is like kind of the philosophical growth hacky part of my brain coming out here. But I remember meeting a guy once who went viral on Kazaa.
I don't even remember what that was, honestly.
The file sharing site. Okay, it's like like LimeWire. But he he made like, there's this music video that like everyone kind of saw in the 2000s, which was Cowboy Bebop, the anime, mashed up with Smooth Criminal by Michael Jackson. If you're over 30 listening to this, chances are you saw this video. I met the guy at a Comic-Con once who made that video. And we talked for a while about like peer-to-peer virality, which is like, what makes somebody show somebody else something? And when I was making Garbage Day, that was the closest analog I could think about for email, which is like, how do you make an email that people would forward to somebody else? And and it's always changing because it's like extremely personal, but I do think it can be done. And I know for a fact that the early days of Garbage Day, that's where the growth came from. Cause I could see similar email domains signing up like in a blast, which like I would call like the Slack room bump, you know, like clearly I got dropped in some company Slack room and then they're all signing up. And so there is a way to do this, but it's finicky and you, and I don't know if you can do it at a scale where like, you know, you can go from 70 to 100,000 readers. But
you know, one thing that you could do is you could do like a referral program where they get your garbage intelligence reports, like on a 2 month delay or something, if they share it with one or two people.
Another project that is on the horizon for me now that tax season is over is figuring out Beehive's referral setup, because I do think that I had one going at Substack and it was very powerful. And I want to reward people who are sharing this stuff. You know, I want to incentivize the right behavior.
Yeah. I'm working on one right now for Creator Spotlight, actually. Yeah. I think we're going to push it live this week. Anyways, though, one other thing I wanted to ask about the move from Substack to Beehive is like, there was a great, you know, for the Beehive employee in me, there was a great moment on Ben's podcast where you are talking about how you moved over to Beehive and the data was so much better. You were like, yeah, I had no idea who my readers were. I think you were exaggerating a little bit, but tell me about like who your reader is and how you got more access to that by moving from Substack to Beehive.
Yeah. I mean, it's still true. The data that Beehive provides is very useful. It has a clearer way of showing where people are coming from. So, you know, I can tell where people are reading me. Obviously, I'm biggest in the United States, but I have a huge amount of readers in Europe, which I was only kind of vaguely aware of. I have a bigger audience in California than I thought. I didn't know those people, you know, read.
New York guy like you.
Yeah, I didn't know people on the West Coast got the internet yet. That's crazy. I have like a much better sense of the amount of people reading me. This is sort of very inside baseball, but I was not aware until recently that Substack, when it gives you its total traffic, is not giving you uniques. It's just giving you every time someone opens the newsletter, which is like misleading. So it has been kind of brutal in a sense to learn the actual kind of scope of my newsletter, but also important because like this is my full-time job. I I pay people to work on it for me. I want this to be a full-time job in the future. And I think that it was very important to go find a host that would not try to sugarcoat it and be able to like do some real maintenance on this thing that started as a passion project. And I think that that is a thing that every creator eventually has to do. The trick is to not destroy the thing that made people like it in the first place by professionalizing it and streamlining it, but like really distilling what works and what doesn't. And so, yeah, the Beehive data has been really useful. The post report is great because I can actually like see who's looking at stuff. I don't know. It's been useful. And I will say, I can share this here. By all accounts, the most read Garbage Day issue ever came while I was at Beehive.
Which one is it?
If you mind sharing. Called AI Search is a Doomsday Cult. And based on what I can tell, it's been read on the web alone 120,000 times.
Holy shit.
I think I'm reading this right. It says web views 121,000, and then insane. Its open rate was 52%. So an additional.
Bragging, damn.
Yeah, I mean that was like the biggest. That's the biggest thing I've ever done. But what's even crazier is like the next one down, Blue Sky's biggest selling points are things that I can't read the whole thing here, but it's a one about Blue Sky was 92,000. So like my traffic is like much healthier now. And I can tell. And it's like, it seems to be real numbers, which is, it's a great feeling.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, that's like mind blowing. So you really are you're a media business. You're a media founder now. And you were kind of touching on that where you were saying like any creator, you know, you have to professionalize and like, that's what that is. Right. So I'm curious too, you have this employee, Adam, who it looks like, I think first worked with you 1 year ago on the first Garbage Intelligence and then came in maybe full-time or part-time, I don't know, as a researcher in November. So tell me about why you brought Adam in and what they do.
Yeah, he's amazing. He used to work at Know Your Meme. We met at a Garbage Day Live event a few years ago, and I was like excited because I was like, oh, whoa, people, I've never met someone who worked at Know Your Meme. It's sort of like this very, like, you never meet them. Like they're like this cabal over in the corner of the internet. And we got to talking and I came up with this idea for this other newsletter writer I spoke to was like, you should have like an enterprise offer. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but sure. And then at the same time, though, I was getting emails from people being like, hey, I love Garbage Day. I wish it wasn't full of stuff about like furries and foot fetishes so that I could send it to my boss. And so I was like, well, this actually might make sense if I just do like a business offering. Mm-hmm. And I was always a huge fan of the NewsWhips and the data miners and like these like services that I was using as a journalist in the 2010s that would show you a snapshot of like what was happening on the internet. And I thought, well, could you just like take as much data as possible from all over the web and organize it in something that like made sense so you could see like what was happening on every platform? So I brought Adam on and he was great. And I was like, I have some money, like let's bring you on to work regularly for me. And then we got a partnership with NewsWhip, who was providing some of their data to us. And it's been awesome because now we have, it's a year now. We have a year's worth of data about the biggest platforms on the internet. And we're able to like track activity and like figure out like, okay, like Twitch is bigger this month than it was last month. And we can try to understand why. And being able to offer that to people has been huge. And then the biggest thing is this month, we just started a partnership with Sherwood News. So they're having us kind of like write little case studies about our data. And it's been great. I mean, and it maybe goes back to kind of your idea about curation being important again. And I think it's possible that people are just really curious, like what's out there, because after Twitter turned into X, it became less useful as like the central nervous system of the internet. And so now there is just nothing there. The newspapers aren't able to do it. Twitter's not able to do it. So we're trying. But yeah, no, I think it's just been, it's been cool to realize that like Garbage Day readers will pay for more information. So mm-hmm. I think our job is to just get better and better information for them and reinvest that back in and figure out how to keep making it useful.
Yeah. So I guess quickly, we don't have to talk about every platform, but you are on, obviously newsletters are your main thing. You have a decent like YouTube presence, video essays there. You've been experimenting with TikTok again recently for the first time in a while. On LinkedIn and Threads, it's kind of just one version of what you do on Twitter, which is just screenshot of your a paragraph from the most recent issue of the newsletter. All that said, what's your relationship with not necessarily any one other platform, but like the need to be on multiple platforms?
I don't know. Right now, like the value of a platform has just become very nebulous, and I'm not really sure. I will say, like, LinkedIn traffic is great. Everybody should be on LinkedIn. It's good. I've noticed it pop up as a referral for me. TikTok is an enigma. I experiment with it. I try to find like a thing that I like doing with it. YouTube is a huge time suck, and it is not easy to monetize. If I ever get like enough money for a video editor, I might just throw them at it and say like, let's figure it out. Because I do think like there's a big audience there, and I like the fact that like you can link on YouTube, which is a rarity. And I just started a audio version of the newsletter, which is like a podcast RSS, which I think is like important just to have. And like, it could be down the line that podcast RSS turns into video content. I was reading recently about this concept called super formats, which I think it was like a Neiman Lab article where they are sort of arguing that like the current internet landscape requires like one giant unit of content that can be cut up into smaller units. So the super format would be like this, basically you record this interview and then it becomes a written piece, it becomes videos, it becomes audio. And it seems like that's kind of the game plan for everyone right now, which I think is a lot of content to be put on a lot of places for like very little value for everyone. But for right now, that's kind of what everyone's doing. So I have started to think of the newsletter itself as a super format, and then the point is to cut up as much of it and put it places rather than the opposite, which is sort of investing time and energy into these platforms. Of course, the platforms get really antagonistic when you do that. So like TikTok has already started to incentivize longer videos that can't fit on Instagram Reels and yada, yada, yada. So there's a lot of like inter-platform politics there, but I do think like it's in the creator's best interest to spend all of their time on the thing that has an audience they can control and distribute to directly and monetize, and like that should be your focus. Like Garbage Day for me is the focus. The platforms are an afterthought, although like I do write the top essay specifically as a way to grab people from social, which used to work really well when Twitter was like very active. And I also just think it's a good exercise for a writer to be like, okay, can this one paragraph from this long essay be read on its own, make sense, and get people interested in reading the rest? And so it's a useful creative exercise. But I don't want to go and make like platform native content just like all the time. No. It just seems like such a drag.
Again, when I interviewed Andrew Huang, he said that like I asked him a similar question. He was like, I just realized that like I don't have to be on every platform. And I mean, he has the luxury of having, you know, 2.4 million YouTube subscribers and a bunch of different income streams, but I think still it resonated with me. But more questions.
Hey, George R. R. Martin has been on LiveJournal for like 30 years, you know, like Neil Gaiman has a Tumblr.
Still.
Like you can just find the thing that you like and just stay there and people will find it, I think.
We'll find you. I was going to say, okay, so besides growth, the other side of newsletters is writing really good stuff. And I think that's always my advice to people when people come into Creator Spotlight and ask me for advice. I'm like, look, the one thing is like just focus on writing something good and putting it out there regularly and you'll get better and et cetera. And it keeps on going. Do you have any particular advice about writing a newsletter that's like unique to that format?
Well, it's not applicable to everybody, but I do think like, so when I'm writing a freelance story, I'm looking for, you know, experts in a subject matter. I like now to go to creators. It's very difficult. And I wish YouTubers were easier to contact because they are experts on the thing that they're making content about all the time. And so like, you know, if I'm working on I was working on a piece the other day about like Marvel movies, and I interviewed a bunch of film essayists on YouTube because I was like, you guys are staring at this stuff all the time. That's like great. And their quotes are fantastic because like they don't have anyone to impress. So they're just, they can tell you honest stuff. And so when I started Garbage Day, I was thinking a lot about the idea of like, what couldn't I say at a desk job with like a media company? And I'll say that because chances are there are reporters working those jobs now who wish they could say that. And then they can just cite me, which did work. It has worked. And I think that like that's the value of being a creator right now, is that you can be the mouthpiece. You can determine how the news articles are written. And it's such a bizarre thing to me that like so many creators are so still like they don't want to play ball with the mainstream media. But it's like punditry, columnists, like this role has existed since the beginning of media. Like someone's always looking for someone who's going to mouth off about the topic they're trying to write against the deadline. So at least for me in my patch, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give ammunition to the reporters I like and care about. And so they'll call me up and be like, you know, what's the deal here? And I think it works. And I think it helps grow your audience because like, I mean, we just saw this with Marcus Brown Lee's review of the Humane Pin. Mm-hmm. Like it works. Like that's our job, I think.
Yeah. To be that like public mouthpiece. So you've been doing this. I checked. You've done 668 issues, unless you've deleted a few. And
good
you've
Lord.
Been, yeah, I know, it's insane. And you've been doing it for 5 years. In 5 years, have you published 1,336 issues, or what is Garbage Day in 5 years?
5 years from now, there's like three possible outcomes for someone like me based on history. Either I just like keep doing it at the rate I'm doing it, it doesn't really grow like astronomically, and I just become like either like a well-respected blogger that people kind of read sometimes, or like a cranky old man who's now insane. That's like one path. The other path is investment, viral growth. All of a sudden things change and Garbage Day becomes Garbage Media. And then that's a whole other set of decisions to make. And then the other
then
one
you
is
acquire
that,
Gawker. Anyways.
Yeah. Then I'd buy the AV Club. Yeah. I think they're not up for sale anymore, but they were, that'd be cool. And that's one version. And then the third version is that like after a while the grind just sort of wears you down and I go get a desk job somewhere. I think I would prefer the second one. I think I would prefer to become a media company. Although being like an insane old man who just like screams about stuff on the internet all day like does sound pretty fun. As of right now, more so than any point in my career, I cannot tell which way the wind is blowing with the internet, which is like exciting and frustrating. So I think like the main thing for like at least the next year of Garbage Day is to just be as flexible as possible, which is really hard for me. So I'm trying my best to just like sort of open myself up to any, you know, the eclipse just happened. It's a big thing for astrological houses. So I'm trying to like open my mind and just sort of like let what happens happen. But we'll see.
Let it go. One more hypothetical for you. One more needless hypothetical. So I think this was in some back issue. I was trying to see if you'd ever written about Stumble Upon because I was thinking about the curation stuff.
I built one.
You built? Okay. Well,
wait, do you know about this? Hold on.
No. Oh, I did. I checked it out. It's broken. I tried to use it. It's broken.
Oh man, really?
Wait. But I would love to use it. I tried to use it. Because yeah, I found it in this. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, it's broken. Nobody was using it. This great reader of mine reached out and we built it last summer and I have to figure out how to fix it now. But yeah, no, I love Stumble Upon. I miss it every day.
Maybe that's a referral thing where that's like reward number for 3 referral or whatever. Anyways, I was trying to find this and I read in a back issue, you said that when you were in college, all you wanted to do was write for blogs. Bad news, Ryan, your wish came true and now your brain is broken. So... if you were 19 in college now, what do you think would it be blogs? What would you be dreaming of doing if you were the same guy, but in college in 2024 or whatever year it is?
My assumption is the me in college would probably be watching a lot of YouTube and would probably be like dreaming of having like a cozy YouTube studio set up. And I assume that's where all the talent is. I assume all the cultural commentary, all that is happening on TikTok and YouTube. And I think that's really sad because like words are good and writing them is fun and like it's easy and you should, I mean, it's not easy. It's
you just do it.
It's a curse. It's an affliction, but like there, there aren't a lot of there might be interesting writers out there under 25, but the apparatuses that we had created to find those writers are broken. So a lot of those personalities are coming in through video, which might not be a good fit for them. And when I talk to people, you know, in their early to mid 20s, like they all talk about that, where they wish they had an office they could go to. And I was like, guys, you'll never believe it. You could get as much free seltzer and coffee as you could handle, and you could stuff your pockets full of granola bars at the end of the day because they're only paying you $30,000 a year. But it's the best job in the world. I met Grumpy Cat. All that stuff is like not happening anymore. And I wish it would. And if I ever became a media company, if any investors want to invest in garbage media, that's the first thing I would do is find a bunch of young people and just give them laptops and let them light the world on fire for a while. Because I do think that is the most fun thing to do. And the world without that is actually quite boring. Yeah. And I think we're beginning to feel how boring that is.
That's kind of what you're doing by hiring Adam, right? Or like somebody, the person I talked to for the Creator Spotlight that goes out this week, she has hired like a few really young people to produce her podcast and such. So I think like that's maybe what the future of that is like as creators professionalize, they look for people who maybe don't have a resume, but they have, you know, their creative project is their business card, and that's what gets them hired.
You have to. Yeah.
You social responsibility.
It's just not as fun without it. Like we need deranged young people to destroy the internet every 5 years, or we end up like this and then this is boring. Like, come on. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a great place to end it. What's the plug? Where should people find you?
Garbageday.email. All of the relevant links, except for my StumbleUpon clone, are there and working. And you can email me directly any sort of hate mail or notes about this recording to ryan@garbageday.email.
This has been episode 9 of the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Thank you, Ryan, for joining me. Thank you, listener, for sticking around to the end. And if you enjoyed it, it would mean a lot if you rated us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I'll see you next week.